Podemos empezar antes de que empiece la conferencia. Es una videoconferencia, como ustedes pueden comprobar en la pantalla. Buenas tardes y gracias por la asistencia ante todo. Es un lo que se dice, un Google Hangout, una videoconferencia con Stephen Downs, que está en estos momentos en Canadá. Como ustedes ven, el horario en canadiense son las 10 de la mañana. Es decir,
as you can see, the Canadian time is 10 o'clock in the morning in Canada. In Canada, so 5 hours less than in Spain. I'd like to ask you a favor. There is a technical issue. Bandwidth, the Wi-Fi network here in this place is quite limited. So maybe if you could, during the time of this video conference, if we could switch the mobile phones off, or at least not to connect to the Wi-Fi network, because we have limited bandwidth in this conference room. So this doesn't affect the quality of the video conference. So please, if you could, dear friends, if you could not use the internet through the Wi-Fi. So, good morning, Ingrid. Good afternoon here in Spain. Stephen, can you hear us, Stephen?
Yes, I hear you just fine. Thank you.
Antes de nada, para que te...
Well, so to give you some feedback, I will show you again the room, the conference room, the webcam. Well, some people are still arriving, and they will be joining us in a few minutes, some more people. I am going to introduce you now. Stephen Downs is Canadian, born in Montreal, and as you know, he's an expert, a renowned world expert on the field of online learning. And he shows that on his many interventions in congresses and conferences all through the world in the 5 continents. His numerous articles, published work, books, papers, etc., and published in many supports, many formats. Right now, Stephen Downs is working at the Council of National Council of Research, National Results Council of Canada, and he's a researcher within this body of the e-learning research group in the at the Institute for Information Technology, and as well as being a theorist, there is some very interesting issue that he applies his commitment to the open contents and to the spreading of open knowledge. And I will give you 2 examples through his webpage, through his excellent website, which is very easy to locate, Canada domain, which is CA. You can find and download under Creative Commons rights most of his interventions, papers, and ebooks in many formats. So it is still easier to access them and to be able to run them through any, almost any device. Another example of his real practical commitment is in the year 2005, he received an award for Edu blog at the best individual blog, because with his blog Alt Daily, which you can also find in his webpage, you can find a link to that weblog. And in one more example of that commitment, Stephen is going to be recording his conference, so you're going to be able to watch that on YouTube. It's one more way of accessing his knowledge, and one more proof of his knowledge with the open knowledge. He's also a photographer. you can see examples in his galleries, in his webpage. And well, as the introducer of this conference, which is called, as you say, the New Processes for the Production, Distribution and Spreading of Knowledge, it is a perfect metaphor, which is the idea that he's going to give us an image, a portrait of the open online communities, learning communities, with the MOOC, the massive open online courses, and the future perspectives of arising out of those courses. So, Stephen, the floor is yours, and when you please, you can start. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. As you can see, I'm located here in my home office in, well, not my home office, it's actually my office here in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. This is where I work at the National Research Council. Here's what it looks like outside today. So you have a sense of what the weather is like here. I'm so sorry you had to see that. The introduction was quite right. I am broadcasting this talk on YouTube right now. It's a live broadcast, and according to my Hangout screen, we have 4 viewers online. I'm also broadcasting it on my online radio station called Ed Radio. And I'm not sure how many people we have online for that. I can take a quick look maybe and find out. But it's always difficult to tell. Let me just reload here. And we have 0 listeners. So that's kind of average for Ed Radio. Ed Radio is the world's least popular radio station, I'm proud to say. Nonetheless, I've been running it for more than a year, and it's just an example of doing something for the sake of doing something. I want to talk today about massive open online courses, and I also want to talk today about open educational resources a bit, how the two of those blend together, and I'll be talking about some of the design principles for massive open online courses, at least the kind that I make, and I'll talk, or I'll show some examples, I'll show some of the software here online that we use, at least, to make our own open online courses. It's not world famous or popular software like Coursera or edX or whatever, but it's been around longer and it's worked pretty well for us. So I'm going to fire up some slides here because I can. And let's see. I always have trouble finding the slides that I want. Because there we go. So let's go back to the beginning. So there we go. There's the slideshow. If you're wondering about that picture on the front, this is a photograph I took a couple of days ago. This is the river that runs through the center of Moncton. As you can see, we've had a little bit of snow recently. So let me begin by talking about what I did yesterday. And what I did yesterday is I went to a website called Complexity Explorer, and I signed on to the online course at Complexity Explorer. And I'm just going to pop in there ever so briefly, and let's see if I can't do this. Whoops, that's not what I meant to do. Oh, well. Well, that's not it. There's no fast way. There we go. So here's the site. And it's just the course that was put online by Santa Fe Institute and Portland State University. And there's an intro video to the course. And so here's the intro video. And it's changed. Oh, it's changed. That's funny. It was the video was about a minute and 30 seconds yesterday. Now it's a 7-minute video. I'm not playing the audio, so you don't need to worry about it. The instructor is Melanie Mitchell. And let's see what's in. Oh, it's just telling us how to sign up and stuff like that. So I signed up for it. I watched the video, which, as I say, was different yesterday. And the point I want to make here is how easy this all was. How easy it was for me to sign up for this course, to watch the video, to begin to get involved with this online course. And that's the thing that is new with massive open online courses. We think about, you know, the number of people in them. We think, oh, there's thousands, hundreds of thousands or whatever people in the course. But to me, what's really important, what's really noteworthy, is how simple, how easy, how low an investment it is to actually begin to take one of these courses and to actually study one of these courses online. According to a site that I saw recently called myeducationpath.com, there are almost 6,000 courses online. When I looked at it the other day, there were 5,918. And of course, this number is going up and up and up. That's an astonishing number of courses. When you consider that in 2008, there were none. And even last year, or at the end of 2011, there was only a handful of courses. And we've gone from that to 6,000 courses today. I run a site called www.mooc.ca. It needs a bit of a redesign because it's become a bit popular. But I've been tracking news about massive open online courses on the site. I have a newsletter which has become very popular on that site. It's not the same as my OL Daily newsletter. And I'll be working with My Education Path to advertise new courses and to help people search for and locate the courses that they're looking for. And it's interesting how global this phenomenon has become in the last year. And it speaks, to me at least, about how popular, how much of a demand there is for massive open online learning. It's interesting because people where I work talk about, you know, you need to show a market pull for these things. You need to show that there is a demand in the marketplace. And to me, an environment where you go from zero to hundreds of thousands of subscribers and thousands of courses in the space of a year shows that there is a significant demand, a significant market pull, again, as they say, for these courses. So anyhow, where did it begin? It began with the first massive open online course. And I said at a talk yesterday, it's a big secret that massive open online courses were invented in Moncton, where I live, but they were. And the first course was CCK08, or Connectivism and Connective Knowledge, 2008. And I just found out the other day the archives from that course are back online. They were off for a while. So you can see the online discussion forum and the course Moodle from the link at the left, and then the daily newsletter, which is the part that I produced, available at the right. So George Siemens and I launched this course, as I say, in 2008. And as we like to tell people, we expected maybe 20, 25 people to join the course. But we set it up so that it would be an open course and a distributed open online course, which I'll talk about through this talk. And instead of 25 students, we got 2,300 students. And that's what started the phenomenon. That's when we realized, and we realized right away, that we had something here, that we were tapping in to something that was going to be important. So we continued doing our own online courses. We did a course, we did CCK 09 the following year, so we repeated the same course and had, again, more thousands of people. We did a course called Personal Learning Environments, Networks, and Knowledge, or PLENK 2010. This was George Siemens and myself, as well as Dave Cormier and Rita Kopp. We also did a course called Change. It was Change 11. It started in 2011 and finished in 2012. Was a very long course, as you can see here, week 35. One of the things we learned about MOOCs with this course was 35 weeks is too long for an open online course. Even so, we had people participate from beginning to end, and in total, we had 2,800 students. We also ran a course in 2012, in conjunction with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Chronicle of Higher Education and some universities. And this was the Future of Higher Education course. It was a short 6-week course, and we had 3,000 students in the course. Now, since we started developing our open online courses, let me just fix that. It bothers me when the slide's not perfect. There we go. Since we started our open online courses, we've seen other organizations develop their own MOOCs. Here I'm presenting a distinction of different types of massive open online courses. I'm borrowing terminology, where the CMOOC and the XMOOC is my own terminology, but the gradation or the line from networks, tasks, and contents, that is a line that was developed by Lisa Lane, and you can see the link to her work there. On the CMOOC side, CMOOC stands for Connectivist MOOC, we have the courses that I just talked about, the CCK08 course, the other courses. Then in the middle, we have what might be called task-based courses. They're not networks as much as our courses are, but they're not as content-based as the more recent MOOCs. These are courses like DS106. And if you have not investigated DS106, I certainly recommend that you take a look. It's a different interpretation of the sort of course that you can have online. And it's very much focused on the creation and the exchange of digital stories. DS in the course name stands for digital storytelling. Then on the far right of this line, we have XMOOCs. The X does not stand for anything, really. It's sort of a borrowing of the term that came from TEDx and came from MITx and edX, where it's maybe it's like extra or something like that. I don't know. But anyhow, the X MOOCs are the MOOCs that were created in the last year or so by generally large American universities and run through open online platforms such as Coursera, Udacity, and some of the rest. And as the listing here suggests, they're based mostly on content. The idea of an XMOOC is that there's a certain body of content that they want students to be able to remember, and the XMOOCs are different ways of going about facilitating that remembering. Probably the original XMOOC would be the online courses created by Salman Khan and the Khan Academy, and that's where many of the XMOOCs draw their inspiration. And these courses are essentially collections of videos. They're low production value, but they're high content and people find them really useful. And compared to nothing, which is the alternative, right? It's always been like Khan or nothing. They're much better than nothing. And they actually work. They actually help people learn these subjects. As time has gone by, with the artificial intelligence course, for example, that was offered by Norvig and Thrun, the video production has improved a bit, and there have become more support materials and more resource materials. But they're still experimenting with the form, much as we have been. Just the other day, there was a course that was offered by Coursera that had to be canceled. The instructor attempted to use Google Documents in order to have people form groups, and this did not work. Basically, what happened is you had 50,000 people trying to edit the same document at the same time. And it shows, and this is one of the things that we learned very early on, it shows that when you have thousands of people in your course, that every aspect of the course has to be automated. You can't have some part of the course that requires human intervention in order for a person to succeed, because even the smallest task multiplied 50,000 times becomes very major. Think about how much time a 1 minute task would take for an instructor or a support technician or whomever for 50,000 people. It's not possible. And anything that is going to require an individual action is going to bog down and create a bottleneck for one of these MOOCs. So we built Connectivist MOOCs, and here is a diagram created by a student in the CCK 08 course of the course, the way we set it up. Now, this is what George and I set up as the course at the start of the course. And you can see some elements in this diagram that may be familiar, and you can see some elements that are new. And it's probably too difficult to read the small boxes, but again, you can see this diagram when you access the PowerPoint slides from my website later. I'll give you the link to that at the end of the presentation. But when we started up CCK 08, we used Moodle to support the course discussion forum. We used a wiki to support administration, to create an outline, and to record where links to the readings and other materials. We used Illuminate and Ustream, supplemented by Twitter, to facilitate live online events. We used Google Groups in order to support additional online discussion as well. We used Facebook groups, the board, the wall, and the photos, along with Facebook profiles for people who wanted to participate using Facebook. We used blog lines and Google Reader. And what we did is we asked each student in the course to create their own blog or their own website. And of the 2,300 participants, about 170 individuals created their own blog and or their own website. And we collected the RSS feeds for these. And we used a program that I wrote called Grasshopper, and we'll look at Grasshopper in a bit, to aggregate or to bring together the contents of those individual blogs. And we could use blog lines or Google Reader to read those RSS feeds, or alternatively, people could subscribe to a daily email newsletter in which we linked to the discussions that were being conducted by course participants. This daily newsletter became, I think, well, and our surveys show, the most popular aspect of the course. We also used a site called PageFlakes, which again is a type of RSS aggregator, in order to create a dashboard view of the online course. We encouraged people to upload contents and then tag them using CCK08 in Flickr or in Delicious or in SlideShare or wherever they wanted. And you get the idea here, right? The idea was that there would not be one single website where we wanted all of the course activity to take place. And we would not be stepping through contents one at a time. Rather, we would have a very distributed website, and we would have a set of resources basically that lived anywhere online. And then the technology that we used to connect the different resources together. So we did not try to present just a series of content. We tried to create and connect and make accessible a wide web of content. And it's interesting, the first complaint from people was, there's too much content. And we said, yes, we agree, there's too much content. No one person can read all of that content. In this way, it's just like the discipline you are studying. There is no way to read, to comprehend, and absorb all of the content in a given discipline. It's not possible. But what we want you as individuals to do is to look at the lists of content and select the content that is most appropriate to you. Perhaps the blog articles that you find most relevant, the people to follow that you might find most interesting, or perhaps content that's in a format most suited to you. Maybe some people prefer videos, other people prefer images, other people prefer text. Each person in the course would select their own subset of content. And then in the course, we encouraged dialogue, discussion, and exchange of ideas in order to facilitate a conversation. And then in this conversation, each person is sharing their own unique perspective or their own point of view. Excuse me. And this leads to the question of how to learn in a MOOC. This is a screenshot from a small video created by Dave Cormier and a link to an article by Tony Bates. But the concept I'm trying to express here is that in a massive open online course, unlike in a traditional course, we are not trying to learn some specific body of content. We're not trying to learn the principles of physics or the four ways to set up a course or whatever. Hang on a sec. I'm still recovering from what was a rather nasty cold and flu last week. So anyhow, rather, the way we learn in a MOOC is that we put ourselves through a process of immersion into a knowing community. It's similar to Etienne Wenger's concept of the community of practice, except it's much less goal-driven than a community of practice. But nonetheless, the concept is the same idea. What we're trying to do in a MOOC is we're trying to put experts and novices and everybody else in between into the same environment. And then in this environment, the experts do whatever it is that the experts do. In the case of our MOOCs, our experts would be experts in educational technology, and they would talk about and demonstrate educational technology. In a physics MOOCs, the experts would be physicists, and they would actually do and talk about doing physics. In a case about law, the experts would be lawyers and judges, and the course would involve participation in and discussion about actual court cases and actual proceedings. And the idea here is that by being immersed in this community, you can watch and follow along with the experts and participate in discussions with other students and indeed even with the experts about these topics. And by talking about these topics, by doing this kind of work, you're immersing yourself into this environment and learning almost as though by osmosis. Now, that does not mean you never study stuff. That does not mean that this is the only way in the world that you learn. But what we're trying to do in these CMOOCs is to create this environment that makes it possible to support this kind of learning and these other kinds of learnings. So, how do you create a MOOC? Really, it's very simple. It's like creating a network. And the steps that you would take to create a network of connections on, say, the internet, that's the same mechanism that you would use to create a MOOC. What you're trying to do here is focus on the creation of links. You're trying to link people to resources. You're trying to link resources to each other to create perhaps concept maps or webs of resources. You're trying to connect people with each other. It's the creation of these links and the facilitation of conversations and interactions in these links that creates a social network. And then people use this social network. They participate in this social network in order to create their own individual knowledge. You know, a good example, and the internet is full of examples. You can find them all over the place. One example is the network of photographers that I've taken part in. And I did it back a few years ago, and I've just started doing it again this year. There's a group of photographers that have as a project to take a picture every day and post it online. and I'm participating in that group. And the idea here is we're doing the action, we're posting our photos, excuse me, and we're exchanging comments about the photos. What I have found doing this is that I've become a much better photographer because I'm not just doing my own photography anymore. I'm putting it out there and hoping somebody out there on the internet responds. By participating in the community, I'm taking my photos, but I'm comparing them side by side to other people's photos. And then I'm talking with them about what I did to create my photo, what they did to create their photo. So I'm learning a skill that is inside my head, right? But I'm learning it by participating in this social network on the internet. We have, in the construction of networks, different principles we can apply, you know, because it's not the case that every network is the same as every other network. I have what I call the semantic condition for the construction of networks, and these are the conditions, in my opinion, and I think the opinion is well-based, but these are the conditions for a constructive dialogue. And these four conditions are autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity. And it's interesting when you read things like James Sawicki, The Wisdom of Crowd, or even Richard Florida on Knowing Societies, how these conditions come out as conditions for, you know, knowledge, conditions for innovation, conditions for creativity. Autonomy means that an individual sets their own objectives, their own goals, their own priorities, and makes their own decisions about learning. It's the concept of learning, directed learning, taken seriously. It's not simply learning, directed learning, where you tell a student what they must learn and how they must do it, and then maybe they do a contract or something like that. It's the idea here is we present the resources for people, we create an environment, but people make their own decisions within that environment with respect to those resources. The second condition is diversity. Diversity means much more than racial or religious or linguistic diversity. Those are the examples that people like to use. But diversity can mean something as simple as supporting both Macintoshes and PCs and Linux and maybe BlackBerry. Diversity means supporting different learning styles, supporting different preferences to learning, making resources available as images or as video. Look at what I'm doing with this discussion. I'm offering an audio feed on Ed Radio and an audio video feed on YouTube. This is supporting diversity. It's also recognizing the diversity of objectives that people have, the diversity of experiences that they have. It's employing diversity as a mechanism rather than having everybody learn the same thing, having everybody learn different things and then talking about that. The third condition is openness. And this is a condition for any successful network. Sorry, I'm really having trouble with my throat. Openness is the idea that the network is open to new members, open to new input, new ideas, and also open to people leaving. There's no locks on the door. People can leave the network, stop participating whenever they want. The idea is you want a fluid, dynamic, changing environment. Openness means there aren't any walls around your course. And what that means is sometimes you don't really know whether a person is in the course or not in the course. And you have different classes or different types of membership in a course. What we found in our experience is there'll be a small core of people participating in the course. But as well, there will be people who are around the core, around the core who participate less frequently or less intensively. And then even people around that who sort of drop by, in our case, you know, read the newsletter, but that's about that. And then even outside that, a sphere of participation where people are what we sometimes call lurkers. They're watching, not watching everything. They're not really contributing, but they're interested in the course and interested in the outcome. And then people are moving in and out of these spheres, participating more or less from week to week, depending on how interested they are in the material. The final condition is interactivity, or I sometimes say interaction, engagement, cooperation is a word that I use a lot in this context. Connectedness is a word I sometimes use. And the idea here is that the content of the course is created as a consequence of people interacting with each other. This is very different from the traditional representation of content. The traditional representation of content in a course is it's the content of a textbook or a professor's lectures or an outline or a syllabus, and you take this content and you're going to transfer it to people in the course. In our version of the course, the content is created by the participants during the course as a result of them each going out and getting their own experience, their own individual perspective on the material, and then exchanging these perspectives. The knowledge is therefore not transmitted. The knowledge is emergent. It develops as a result of or as a consequence of these interactions and is not the content of these interactions. Sorry, it's such a nasty cold. I really don't recommend anybody catch it.
No queremos. Hemos puesto el antivirus.
Well, we have the antivirus here, just in case.
Yeah, very good.
We don't want to abuse your throat. But as I said at the beginning, you were a photographer.
That's
and
correct.
You had a great repository of images and this idea of mocks. And maybe we're running a bit late. Maybe... I don't know if you want to add something. If not, we can let people ask questions or start the debate with the public.
We could do that. Let me just give you the link to my website. So there it is. Oh, you can't see it yet. Hang on. So there's the link to my website on the screen.
Sí.
And it's simply www.downs.ca, and one more thing here. So now here's the photos that I was talking about. one photo every day. And I started in January, so there's the little house that I live in. And it's being slow. There's my cat. There's Ganesh from India. And so on. There's a basketball game being played here in Moncton. And it's interesting because, you know, sometimes people make comments, but you can see here's our group, the One Pick a Day group. It was formed, I think, by Grania. So here are the photographs that are contributed by all of the members. So we look at them and we exchange comments on the photographs with each other, which I think is pretty cool.
Bueno, una cosa que no les comenté al principio.
One thing I didn't tell at the beginning, Stephen, apart from a photographer, is almost a professional player of darts. And I think he really reached the goal with his conference. Stephen, thank you very much. Then we will start the debate.
Okay.
So we now open, if you agree, 10 minutes maybe. Sure. For a debate, it can be a suitable time. Yeah, any questions from the floor? Yes, please be very specific and please speak slowly so we can...
Thank you very much for your presentation and for staying here with us. I speak in Spanish, but someone translate you. Yo quisiera preguntarle.
I would like to ask you, I'm sure you know, there's criticism about all these mocks. Some people say that, well, maybe there are problems with the massification of the students, the huge amount of interaction, and the dropouts also. These are issues. Mm-hmm. And I would like to ask, what is your assessment of your proposals? And if you have any survey, any analysis on that, on the profile of students, or of the people that are at least sign up for the courses. Which is the profile of this student? Which are the futures? And what are the conditions that a person needs in order to be able to access these courses and to be able to go through it?
Sure. That's a lot in one question. We did surveys of the people who took our courses, and I want to emphasize that our surveys are appropriate only for our courses, and I believe the demographics for other courses are probably very different. But the people who took our courses tended to be older. They tended to be more educated. Many of them were retired. They tended to be professional. They tended to come from North America or Europe. We did have a certain representation of younger people and people from around the world, but they were a minority in our course. Like other MOOCs, we would have a significant number of people sign up at the start of the course and then disappear. So the what they call the dropout rate is substantial. And really, in a course, we would expect there to be a core of 15 to 20% that would, of the original number of people that signed on, that would stay on with the course through to the end. And but you know, it's really hard to measure, and there are different measures. The 15 to 20% figure, I get that figure from the number of blogs that were created, or other websites that were created and that people posted to. You know, we're harvesting content on a daily basis. So, as I said, in the first course, for example, we had 2,300 participants. We had 170 blogs. In the change course, we had something like 320 blogs. So there is that number of people who participate on a regular basis, who contribute on a regular basis. On the other hand, another way of measuring participation is, did they sign up for the newsletter and stay signed up? So did they keep reading the newsletter all the way through the course? These numbers are very consistent. We would have, well, like in the CFHE course, we had more than 3,000 people sign up for the newsletter and stay signed up beginning to end. So, you know, people might be listening, or they might be getting the newsletter and deleting it without reading it. It's hard to tell. But on the question of dropouts, dropping out of a MOOC is not the same as dropping out of an open of a traditional course, and that's one of the things I tried to emphasize at the beginning of this talk. The investment to join a MOOC is, you fill out a form with your name and email. Compare that to the investment to join a traditional course, where you have to, you know, become admitted by the university, pay a tuition fee, quit your job, go to the town, set up a new residence, attend the classes on campus. You know, if you drop out of one of those courses, it's very serious. If you drop out of a MOOC, who cares? And I think that what MOOCs are doing is eliminating the risk inherent in trying new courses or following new areas of academic interest. So in a very real sense, the dropout rate in a MOOC is a good thing. Now, it's also important that people are getting out of these courses what they want. And it doesn't mean always completing the course or memorizing a certain set of facts. Different people have different objectives. And it doesn't mean we should not be measuring for that and evaluating for that. And my observation, again, is that there is this core of participants who stick with the course to the end that find the course to have been useful and influential. One of the nice things about massive open online learning is you don't have to try to please everybody. You please who you please, and you can satisfy their needs very well, and the other people who you do not please go on to do something else. Finally, the last part of the question related to what kind of preparation, background, and skills, etc., you need in order to successfully participate in a MOOC. And of course, you need internet access. And the better the internet access, the easier it is to participate in the course. To me, the big difference in the usefulness of the internet came when I went from being connected from time to time to connected all of the time. In other words, when I made the transition from dial-up internet to broadband internet, having the internet always on means that you can do things like attend these courses just as a pastime. You know, you have 5 or 10 minutes free between other things that you're doing. You can pop into a course or watch a video or something like that. It's not the dedicated event that it has to be if you're only able to access the internet at certain times. Certainly having broadband as well is important if you're going to be using multimedia, like video or even audio, although these days audio can be broadcast at very low bandwidths. That's why I maintain my radio station, so that people with very poor internet bandwidth can still benefit from the online presentation. Not that they take advantage of that, but it's there. As well, I am told that people need to be very literate, very self-motivated, very interested in the subject matter. There's a whole bunch of requirements like that. I'm not completely convinced of that. I am and I'm not. Certainly, the participants in our MOOCs did satisfy those criteria. And I think that a person needs, in the first instance, to be motivated in order to succeed in a MOOC. The nature of MOOCs suggests that many people who do sign up for them will be motivated because people are taking these voluntarily. They're not being assigned a MOOC. If you start assigning people to MOOCs, you're going to hit this motivation problem right away. But if people are directing their own education, that addresses much of the motivation problem. As for literacies, I think one of the reasons for the popularity of video, especially in, you know, the ex-MOOCs, is that video is good for people who do not have strong reading skills. You know, one of the things about Khan Academy was that he made mathematics and physics very accessible to people without strong reading skills. And they were able, through the presentation of those videos, to develop their reading skills by participation in these classes. And we've experimented with that. We ran a course called Critical Literacies, where we attempted to see whether people could learn the skills they need to learn in a MOOC. We still don't know the answer to that. But I think that internet technologies can, as they say, scaffold people into higher and higher levels of capacity so that people can start taking these courses at a low level and increase their capacity.
Well, I think we have used up all of our time. I don't know if there is more questions. If you can be very quick, and please.
I'll answer it more quickly, too.
One last question, because we are almost out of time. Yes, thank you very much. My question is related to the implication of the community, the involvement of the community, the development of the MOOCs. How do those thousands of persons that get involved in the course are making that other local associations, group get involved as well, groups concerned with the community, etc.? What is the social dimension of your work? Not only the individual dimension, which makes subjects join together, to come together, to learn you.
Sure. And that's a good question. We observed, especially in the first MOOC, but in all subsequent MOOCs, that people do tend to cluster together. In CCK08, for example, we had several groups form their own Second Life community. We see people form communities around a Twitter hashtag or around a Facebook group or a Google group. These groups are largely self-organized. And the way we support them is basically we say, you know, in our newsletter and other publications, we encourage you to create groups. And if you create a group and want to share that group or get more members, tell us about it. Write a blog post or whatever, or send us an email, and we will advertise the existence of that group in the newsletter. And then the other thing we do is, when this group begins to produce things like discussion posts or images or videos or whatever, we aggregate or harvest those new things and bring them into the newsletter. Now, there's no requirement that they share, and sometimes they don't, but the possibility that people can form their own group and still be part of the course, an official part of the course, we find is very conducive to the formation of these groups. But, you know, some people like it, some people don't. Some people join groups, other people don't. And that's the way it should be. You know, the idea that a Coursera course would have everybody in the course join groups, I think, is ludicrous. You make it available for those who want it, and not required for those who don't.
Well, we don't have time for more, fortunately. We could be here all the afternoon, but the time is limited. I want to thank sincerely Stephen and your contribution. And I want to thank the public here and technical team that has made possible, so the interpreter, and for us to have been able to communicate. So thank you very much to all the people involved. Thank you.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure being able to speak with all of you.
Vamos a cortar entonces.
We're going to cut the connection now.
And that's the end of the session.